honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, reminding you that with Veterans Day approaching on Thursday, November 11th, to be ready to salute all those who have served, but especially those in your circle. Make it a point to personally thank those you know. And when you're looking for heroes, Pueblo, Colorado is a pretty good place to start. It is known as the home of heroes, thanks to four Medal of Honor recipients that are from Pueblo, and also a breathtaking public memorial there that lists the names of every American who has ever been awarded the Medal of Honor. It's also home to the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum, where one of the docents, Bill Barrett, celebrated his 102nd birthday this past week. You heard him talk about his role in encoding and decoding important messages in the Pacific.
Did you feel a sense of responsibility or maybe even pressure to not mess this up?
Well, probably yes. I was the non-commissioned officer in charge of the Signal Center. After I made staff sergeant, they promoted me to in charge of the Signal Center. I didn't do a lot of coding and decoding after that. I more or less had to see that everything got done.
And were you hoping to head overseas, or would you have been just fine staying stateside?
I figured I would be sent overseas, yes.
And you went over pretty early.
Yes, I did. 6 months after I was in the service, I was sent overseas. September 1st.
September 1st, 1942.
We left the States.
Where'd you go?
Well, I tell people that I had a 29-day all-expense-paid cruise to Brisbane, Australia from San Francisco with a 3-day stopover in the Fiji Islands.
Sounds pretty luxurious, Bill.
Well, accommodations weren't like they are today on a cruise.
Had you ever been at sea before?
No, I had not.
I was going to say, young guy from Kansas, maybe a creek or a river is about as big as it gets.
I've been in a small boat.
Uh-huh.
Going fishing or something. Got off the ship. They took us up to a little town called Ipswich, Australia, where there was an army air base called Amberley Field. And I understand, I've talked to some people from Australia, that Amberley Field is still there.
How about that?
Yeah. We spent about 3 months there, and we didn't do a lot. They had us out in the field about a half a mile away from the main camp, and we had to walk down there to our meals and stuff. We didn't do any communication until we got to New Guinea.
Did you think you might be in danger?
No.
No? Even though...
Not in our conditions, no. We had a lot of air raids, and that was all. I wasn't in the combat unit, and there wasn't any fighting close by. But we did have several air raids, and we actually lost some people in our unit in air raids.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's dangerous. Japanese bombers can kill you.
Yeah, that's true. My oldest brother was in Normandy about 3 or 4 days after they invaded it. He did get injured and got some shrapnel in his leg. They sent him back to a hospital and for a few days and then right back to the front.
So for you, you said 3 months there at Ipswich?
December 5th of 42, we left Australia. Our company occupied the first hole of the ship, a makeshift ladder to go up and down, and we had to sleep on the floor. It took 6 days to reach our destination.
So then you get to New Guinea.
Right.
And you're going to spend the next year and a half there?
Yes, from December 42 to May of 44.
So you must have gotten used to it.
Oh, yeah. But I spent about three different areas.
Uh-huh.
We were at near Port Moresby, at Milne Bay, and at Ora Bay.
And what kind of work were you doing?
Communications. We were the first telephone exchange, American telephone exchange in New Guinea.
Uh-huh. Can you give us a sense of the nature of these communications? Are you aware of what's being communicated all the time?
On some of them. We had to send a lot of reports back to headquarters at the end of the day. That's where it kept us busy most of the night. That's where we saved the routine messages for that communication that went back to headquarters. We knew some of the things that were going to happen during the war, maybe knew what was going to happen, but we didn't know exactly where or when.
Now you're talking about like invasions, islands?
Landings and stuff like that.
Yeah. Is that hard to think about when you know something like that's going to happen? I mean, do you think about those young men who are going to be crashing onto those beaches?
Oh, sure you do, yeah. You think about them, worry about them, and wonder how many of them's going to survive.
Yeah. And how about the role of communications in general? I mean, what would have happened if those messages that you're receiving and sending don't get through?
I don't know.
Probably would have cost some people some lives, right?
It could have, yeah. After I finished this book, this is how I ended it.
Right.
I was not waiting to shore at Omaha Beach. I was not fighting the enemy across the fields and towns of France and Germany. I was not flying in an airplane bombing the cities of Europe, or flying a fighter plane escorting our bombers, or shooting down enemy planes. I was not fighting in the jungles of New Guinea, or storming a beach of some island in the South Pacific. I was not one of the 400,000 that never made it back home. However, the 912 Signal Company I was assigned to had a significant role in the war in the South Pacific. The supply of the final equipment and the operation of communications for all the units of General George C. Kennedy's 5th Air Force in New Guinea was the mission of the 912 Signal Company. In conjunction with the 27th Air Depot Group, the organization was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation for Outstanding Merited Service and Achievement during the Papuan Campaign. The model signal depot established by the 912 Signal Company at Port Moresby has become the criterion upon which all other Signal Corps units of the Far East Air Force have been set up. From the 13th of December 1942 to 25th of April 1945, when the unit left Port Moresby to set up a signal depot in the Netherlands New Indies, the 912 Signal Company has played a significant part in turning back the Japanese and in hoping to help make the eventual doom of the Japanese Empire.
So they said, you guys are the standard.
Yeah.
Your
right.
signal company. That's how they want them all to work.
That's right. The very first night we got into Port Moresby, we had an air raid.
Very first night.
Very first night.
Welcome to Port Moresby,
yeah.
Bill.
Yeah. So all we could do was just stand there and look.
And what do you see?
We had set up our pup. Well, you see the planes in the searchlights.
And you see bombs coming out of the planes?
You couldn't see them, no, but you could hear them after they hit.
How close did they hit to where you were?
Just over the hill at the airstrip.
Uh-huh.
One night later on, a plane did sneak in behind one of our airplanes and drop some bombs, and one of them landed in a theater area. And it just happened that the movie had been over for a few minutes, so there were a few kids still hanging around, and some of them were killed. In fact, we lost three kids from our outfit that night.
From your company?
From our company, yeah.
And a couple things here. So if it had been 5 minutes earlier, you would have lost a lot.
Lost a lot of people, yeah.
Were you in the theater?
No, I did not go that night.
Did you usually go?
I went to a lot of theaters because that's about the only thing I was to do at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why
and
didn't you go that night?
I have no idea. I might have been working.
It's okay,
possible,
sure.
It's possible I could have been working that night.
And the young men who were killed, did you know any of them?
I know all three of them because they were in my communications.
So you'd spent quite a lot of time with these guys.
Oh, yeah.
How hard was that for you to deal with?
It was pretty hard to miss them. Especially one of them in particular was a very intelligent gentleman, very nice gentleman, and had a lot of stories to tell, and he was really a character, and everybody enjoyed him, and we really missed him.
Did that kind of change the tenor of your company after that?
I don't think so, no.
Did you ever feel like, well, maybe that could happen to me, too?
It's possible, very possible, yeah.
Were you prepared for that?
Well, you take it as it came. If you got hit, you got hit. When they start dropping those bombs, you never know where they're going to go.
I'm sure a lot of your visitors here at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum know who Dick Bong was.
A lot of them don't.
Well, you get to educate them then, right?
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of them about it and showed them the pictures that I have. Yeah.
So tell me how this all developed. You guys were actually sending the message that the record for the most aerial victories had been broken?
No, we knew, I forget how, but we do know that he broke this record.
Yeah, so Dick Bong was a P-38 pilot in the Pacific.
Right.
And the record for kills in aerial combat was held for a long time by Eddie Rickenbacker
in
from
World War One. World War One, yeah.
But Bong ends up breaking it in his P-38.
Yeah, by shooting down 27 enemy planes. Rickenbacker did 26.
So Bong gets his 27th.
Right.
You guys hear about it.
Right. And so a couple of days later, some of my friends and I went over to the airstrip to see if we could find his plane, and we were lucky enough to find it. And I happened to have my camera with me. I got a picture of his plane, the whole plane. I got a picture of the 27 flags painted on the side of the fuselage.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a picture of me and one of my buddies sitting on the wing of his plane.
It's a great picture. I'm going to put that up at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I wonder how many people have a picture like that, Bill.
Not very many, I don't think.
Yeah.
On the plane, yeah.
Did you have to ask anybody's permission?
No, there wasn't anybody there but three of us.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, wasn't anybody around the plane at all that day.
And he wasn't done.
Oh, no, he ended up doing 40.
How amazing is that?
Yeah, that's amazing, yeah.
So he breaks the record, and then MacArthur's coming to Port Moresby to congratulate him.
To congratulate him, yeah.
And you were there?
I was there. Well, this was the same day that we were saw the plane.
Uh-huh.
And around one of the, they call them a revetment?
Uh-huh.
Revetment,
yeah.
There was a bunch of people standing, and one of the guys come over and talked to us. He must have been one of the photographer or reporters or something. He said, if you guys want to stick around a while, they'll make with your time. But they wouldn't let us get very close.
Uh-huh.
In fact, we kind of had to set up on the top of the revetment. And pretty soon the plane came in, and MacArthur came out of it. And I didn't get a picture of him. But so far away, you couldn't hardly tell who it was, except he was a little bit taller than everybody else.
How excited were you to come home?
Really excited. You'll never know how excited you are to get it discharged and get to come home and see your family and your girlfriend. That was the highlight of my Army career, I think.
Well, tell me about that moment. How did that all unfold?
I was discharged in Denver, and I came home on Rock Island Rocket, which is a train that came through my hometown. And my dad and my little sister, my girlfriend, and I don't know, 8 or 10, 12 of my friends are all there to greet me. It was a great time to see all of them and get to hug my girlfriend and get a kiss her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys didn't have that experience.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of them never came home.
Some, even if they did, 3 years is a long time to wait for a boyfriend.
Well, that's true. A lot of them got Dear John letters.
I'm sure there were some guys in Belleville that had eyes on Lillian.
Well, yeah, I'm sure of that.
So how long did you wait to pop the question?
I'm not sure how soon we talked about it, but we were married less than a month later.
So you wait all of a month to get married to Lillian after she's waited for you to get home for 3 years. You guys go on to have a couple sons. You've got a couple granddaughters. You ever think about what if? What if you were in the theater that night? What if you were one of those more than 406,000 Americans who didn't come home?
Yeah. What if I never made it home? Well, there wouldn't be two great boys, two great granddaughters.
Yeah. How does that make you feel?
Well, makes me feel pretty proud of all my family.
Have you been back to Washington and the National World War II Memorial?
Oh, yes. I got on that honor flight.
Uh-huh.
That they have. Are you familiar with that?
Very.
Okay. I went with that with my brother. He and I went together.
You and your brother got to go together.
On the honor flight out of Denver.
How much trouble did you guys cause?
I don't know. He was in a wheelchair most of the time. He was getting along. He was 2 years older than I was.
Tell me about that experience. What'd you get out of it?
Oh, it's a great experience for me, especially being with him. Meant a lot to me, seeing it together.
And I know you tend to downplay your time in the war, even though you were overseas a lot longer than most World War II veterans.
That's true, yeah.
Did that honor flight experience, the way people treated you in D.C., the way they treated you back here in Colorado when you came back, did that give you a new perspective on what you had done and what it meant to people?
Well, not really. You know, I feel what I did was necessary. It had to be done. But I feel sorry for all those guys that were in the infantry and fighting and all that kind of stuff. And with what they did and what I did, I don't think I did too much. That's my feelings.
Well, I've heard a lot of guys say that to me. But
yeah.
But the rest of us know that we wouldn't be here without you.
Yeah, that's
your
true.
Sons wouldn't have been born, for sure, if you didn't come home.
Yeah.
The world would be a much different place.
That's true.
If you hadn't done what you did.
Yeah.
That memorial itself, when you look at all those gold stars,
what
comes to mind? What'd you think about when you were looking at that?
Well, you feel sorry for them that didn't make it back home.
Were there any moments of that trip back to D.C. that kind of stand out for you that were real impressive or meant something to you?
Yes. And they had Europe on one side, the Pacific on the other side, and they had the one named New Guinea.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a lot of time in New Guinea, so I got down beside it and had my son take a picture of me with the New Guinean right beside me. That might have been one of my highlights.
I bet when you're here in this gift shop, you get some opportunities to talk to people who certainly weren't alive when World War II was happening.
Right, yeah.
What's the most important thing that you think people need to know about what happened, about the young men and women that served our country during that time?
Well, I think they need to think about the people that never made it back home. They need to think about the people that served. That's about it.
What would you say that you're most proud of, Bill?
During my service?
In life in general, sure.
Oh, well, being married and having my family.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But during the war, I think probably what we did, the communication that we did for the service, probably the most important thing I did.
Were there ever nights over there in the Pacific where you're sitting in that tent and you're wondering, am I ever going to see Lillian again?
Yeah, you never knew. you could get hit, like I say, get hit in an air raid or have an accident of some kind and not make it.
He made it, and he's still making it to the Pueblo Wise Broad Aircraft Museum in Pueblo, Colorado, every Saturday, even at age 102. So often on this program, we talk to veterans who experienced intense combat on the ground, at sea, or in the air. But Veterans Day this week is our chance to thank not just those, but all who have served in any capacity. And I hope the examples we heard from Clarence Suzuki and Bill Barrett today serve as a reminder that every single role was crucial in preserving freedom during World War II, just as they are today and just as they will be in the future. So make sure to thank the veterans in your life this week and join us again next time on Hometown Heroes, where we try to remember on Veterans Day and every day that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.